Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Travel Masters, Inc. versus Star Tours.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom McCorkle will present argument for petitioners. Mr. McCorkle has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, the facts in this case that I think are germane to the issue brought up on the writ that has been granted in this case are threefold. The non-compete covenant signed by Donna Goldsmith in this case was contemporaneously done with acceptance of employment. It was entitled Employee Non-Competition Agreement. It was not an employment contract per se. There were no provisions in it for duration or compensation, duties or responsibilities. And the employment relationship between Star Tours and Donna Goldsmith was at will. The petitioners contend that the non-compete covenant is not enforceable for failure to meet the first criteria for enforceability under DeSantis and Martin. That is, that a non-compete covenant must be ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement or relationship that whose primary purpose is unrelated to the suppression of competition. The Court of Appeals in this case simply held that this non-compete covenant was ancillary to the valid employment relationship of Donna Goldsmith and Star Tours because she signed this covenant at the time she accepted employment. The Martin case.
Mr. Corkle, may I ask you if you basically make two contentions, one that the non-compete agreement was unenforceable and the damages for tortious interference with contractual relations are not recoverable if the covenant not to compete is unenforceable.
Yes, that's the point.
Is there any effective means by which an employer in Texas can protect their investment in the time and training of an employee at will in light of your arguments?
Yes.
Tell me, please, how that is.
Well, if an employer has an employee with whom he wants to engage in a non-compete covenant, for some reason, he's got to have a legitimate interest to protect, number one. I think the janitor situation is not going to be subject to a non-compete, but if it's an important employee that has gives rise to an interest worthy of protection, then the employee has got to have this covenant. It's got to be ancillary. That is, it's got to be, and I think ancillary means, from looking back at some of the old cases, in support of, incident to, and in support of another contract.
But that can never happen in the context of an employment at will, can it? Is that your
argument? Well, no, because if it's an employment at will, it's not an otherwise enforceable contract.
So the point is, where there's an employment at will, you can never have a non-competition agreement.
Yes, you probably could. But I'm raising what I think is a new theory here that wasn't addressed in the Martin case. If you have a at-will employment relationship, you can make it not at-will if it's not contemporaneous. In other words, if it's like Martin 3 years later, if there's independent consideration for entering into the non-compete, and the
But it's got to be an employment contract in addition, right?
I think so, yes.
So it takes it out of the at-will.
It'll have to become not, yes. If it's at-will, then the employee has nothing to look forward to. He can be terminated literally the next day, and then he's bound by a non-compete.
So is it true, based on your contentions, that there is no way that an employer in Texas can protect their investment in time and training of an employee at will by a covenant not to compete or by recovering damages for tortious interference with contractual relations?
I do not believe so, although I'm sure that we're going to be exploring that out in the practice. I'm tired of attacking these. I'd like to be supporting some sometime and try to create one that's enforceable. That's something to be looked into, but I think if right now, under the state of the law, if the at-will attribute is there, then the employee has nothing himself. And of course, the employer is not very well protected under at will either, because both sides can walk away from it at any time. Now, our contention is that whether or not the execution of a non-compete covenant is contemporaneous with acceptance of employment. Now, we're not talking about contracts of sale for a business. We're talking about just employment contracts. That's not the test under Criteria 1. That's the test which the Court of Appeals in this case says controls, but I don't believe that's the case. Martin holds two things, really. Martin says, of course, that was 3 years after he accepted employment. He signs a non-compete and then goes off on his own. The court in Martin said that a non-compete covenant is not ancillary to an employment agreement as a matter of law if that employment agreement consists entirely of the non-compete covenant. It's question number one. If you look, if you have a non-compete covenant, that's all there is to the employment agreement. As a matter of law, it's not ancillary. You needn't ask any further questions. But the court went on in that case to say that even if it is ancillary, and I think what it meant there, what the court meant, was that if it's contemporaneous, because, you know, if it's not contemporaneous, it can't be ancillary. It's got to be something else. So even if it is ancillary and the employment agreement itself is at will, the employment relationship, then that is not, by definition, a, quote, an otherwise enforceable agreement, unquote. That's what Martin says. The respondents will argue in this case, in defense of the rationale of the Court of Appeals, that that's what makes this case different, and all the rationale and principles evoked in Martin do not apply because this lady signed the non-compete agreement, which was the entire agreement, on the day she went to work. I don't know why they rationale that. The opinion only casually refers to Martin in a footnote. And it says that, and it's true what it says. It quotes Martin. It says a non-compete covenant, and I'm talking about the court below, a non-compete covenant which is executed on a date other than the date on which the underlying employment agreement or underlying agreement is executed is enforceable only if it is supported by independent valuable consideration. Well, that's true. And I think the only argument that can be made, and I'm not making the argument, is that if you have a non-contemporaneous execution of a non-compete and a acceptance of employment, that is never ancillary. Don't ask the ancillary question. Ask whether there's valid consideration. But Martin, and later in 1990, after Martin, the Daytona case, which I'll give you the cite on in just a moment. It was a found case and passed me right by. I apologize. It wasn't in my brief. but you don't have to even get to the ancillary if it's not contemporaneous. If the execution and acceptance of employment is contemporaneous, then ask the ancillary questions. And if it's ancillary, that is, if there is an employment agreement there that states duration, perhaps, or compensation, or duties and responsibilities, but is otherwise determined to be an at-will employment, and I have found, I submit that it's, there are many contracts out there that say just that. Here's what your duties are, but this contract is terminable at will by either party. By its own terms, becomes an at-will contract. Then that is, by definition, not an otherwise enforceable agreement, and this cannot be answered. It makes it unenforceable. Now, the Daytona case, Daytona Group of Texas, Inc. versus Smith, is cited at 800 Southwest 2nd 285 out of the Corpus Christi Court. 1990, the writ was denied by this court. That is almost identical to the Martin case, where this lady was working as a radio advertising salesperson. Some years after she went to work for the company, it was bought out by another company, and they compelled her to sign a non-compete agreement, which she signed and then left, and a lawsuit ensues. The Corpus Christi Court reasoned that, just like the Supreme Court did in Martin, that the underlying employment agreement consisted entirely of the non-compete covenant. There was no other employment agreement. And that the employment agreement also was at will. and therefore it's not enforceable. And that's the way I would submit the Court of Appeals in our case should have reasoned our case. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Randy Roberts will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, there are additional facts that are relevant to the question of reasonableness and enforceability in this case. Donna Goldsmith was hired by Star Tours specifically for the purpose of helping that company generate domestic travel business. Her prior experience had been as a reservationist working for another travel agency. When she was hired, she was placed in a position to have direct customer contact specifically for the avowed purpose of helping generate domestic travel business. For that, she was given additional compensation. She was given a higher rate of salary than other employees, and she was given commissions for all of the domestic travel that she generated, a type of structure which none of the other employees had at that time. In the Henshaw versus Kronecke case, this court stated that an employer has a right to protect against an employee establishing a rapport with the clients.
What case is this?
Henshaw.
Are all those cases suspect in light of Fowler and Martin, those later cases?
Your Honor, in the recent case of Maine Herdman versus Haas, which was decided by this court about a month ago, is in the Supreme Court Journal. I don't know that the rehearing has been ruled upon yet. The court basically reiterated the precise holding in Henshaw, and there ruled that the restrictive covenant was more expansive in its definition of what clients were, and it was more expansive in the scope of activities that were prohibited, but reiterated the principle. In fact, went further and said that the fundamental business interest that an employer can protect by a non-compete clause is to prevent his employee from coming in, establishing a rapport with his clients, and upon termination, taking part of that business with him. This is especially true, this is hinted at in the DeSantis case, and it's especially true in a situation like this, where the employee is hired for the specific purpose of creating and generating that goodwill.
But it still must be ancillary, folks. That does not deny, that does not remove the ancillary requirement. What agreement is this ancillary to?
Your Honor, this agreement is ancillary to the employment relationship. It is also ancillary to the specific compensation that Ms. Goldsmith was given. It was ancillary to the special training that she was given to become a supervisor, to become a manager. And it was that training, that experience, that allowed her to go out and compete successfully and run her own operation after she left Star Tours.
That goes to consideration, and there's no question, I suppose, that she received consideration for this agreement. But the ancillary requirement suggests more. It suggests that there needs to be some mutuality of obligation here. Petitioner argues that she could have been fired the next day.
Your Honor, that
would have had no recourse and would have still been bound by this agreement. What's your response?
Your Honor, my response to that is basically threefold. Number one, the evidence does not establish this was an at-will relationship. The evidence is that Ms. Goldsmith was hired for a monthly salary. She testified to that on two separate occasions. She was hired at a monthly salary, was later increased, and at the end was still receiving a monthly salary. The law in the state of Texas, as most recently enunciated in Winograd versus Willis at 789 Southwest 2nd 307, Houston 1st District 1990, writ denied, is that where the terms of employment are for a specified period, whether it's weekly, monthly, or annually, that is not an at-will relationship. Rather, it is an employment for a specific term.
Is there evidence of an agreement to continue her employment month by month?
Your Honor, that is implied by law in the fact that she was hired for a monthly salary and it renews itself monthly. That has long been the law in the state of Texas. The Winograd case cites numerous other cases Also, the Molnar versus Ingalls case, San Antonio, at 705 Southwest 2nd 224, I believe, specifically says that can be an oral agreement. It does not need to be in writing.
But is there evidence of it?
Yes.
Of an oral agreement?
The evidence is that she was hired and was given a monthly salary. That is evidence of an oral agreement for a monthly employment that renews itself monthly. That is not an at will. My second point is that in the situation where an employee is hired in an at-will relationship and is terminated the next day, I would suggest that there are other remedies that would prevent enforcement of an otherwise reasonable covenant, such as the possibility of fraud, the failure of consideration, promissory estoppel, or a plethora of other remedies. That's not the situation that we have here. Each of these cases must be judged on its own merits. And the fact that one employee may be terminated one day after being hired shouldn't ruin an otherwise reasonable covenant in a situation where the employee works for several years, establishes a clientele, a goodwill for her employer, and then leaves in a malicious manner and takes that business with her, opens up the next day, and opens with that book of business already intact. The third point is the most important, and that is in DeSantis, this court basically adopted the proposition set forth in the restatement of contracts in sections 187 and 188. It enunciates those principles as being the three criteria for determining the reasonableness, and the first of those criteria is that it must be ancillary to an otherwise valid transaction, relationship, or agreement. And Martin, the language is turned a little bit and focuses on agreement or contract. However, restatement and DeSantis talk in terms of relationships. In section 187 of the restatement, section 187 says, a promise to refrain from competition that imposes a restraint that is not ancillary to an otherwise valid transaction or relationship is unreasonably in restraint of trade. It goes on to say in the comment in section B, in order for a restraint to be ancillary to a transaction or relationship, the promise that imposes it must be made as part of that transaction or relationship. A promise made subsequent to the transaction or relationship is not ancillary to it. In the case of an ongoing transaction or relationship, however, it is enough if the promise is made before its termination, as long as it is supported by consideration and meets the other requirements of enforceability. In section 188, subsection 2, the restatement says that promises imposing restraints that are ancillary to a valid transaction or relationship include the following: B, a promise by an employee or other agent not to compete with his employer or other principal. In comment G to that section, it says that a restraint may be ancillary to a relationship, although, as in the case of an employment at will, no contract of employment is involved. That comment directly covers the at-will situation and says that a covenant not to compete, if otherwise reasonable, is ancillary to an employment relationship, even though the employment relationship is at-will. Taken together, what this means is that if it arises at the inception of the employment relationship, it is automatically ancillary to it, even though it's at-will. If it arises subsequent to the commencement of the relationship, as in Martin, there must be independent consideration. The point is that in this situation, it is ancillary as a matter of law because it arose at the commencement of the relationship. Moreover, there is independent consideration in any event, being the special training that Ms. Goldsmith received, as well as the additional level of compensation that she received. I would also suggest that there's an interesting question that is confronted when looking very carefully at the DeSantis case, especially in light of the Hill decision. In Hill, the court enunciates four criteria for determining the reasonableness of covenants not to compete. One of the four criteria in Hill is whether there is consideration. In DeSantis, this court said there are three criteria, and then in footnote 6 says that, the court says that there are three criteria to determine reasonableness. Covenants that are not reasonable are void and against public policy as a matter of law. In footnote 6, the court says that there are other reasons for which covenants not to compete may be unenforceable, such as lack of consideration. The premise being that if a covenant fails for lack of consideration, it is not necessarily unreasonable. If it is not unreasonable, it is not void as against public policy, and we fall squarely within the decision of Clements versus Withers, where this court held, and that case was also cited in the Julia Fowler case, where a contract that is unenforceable, there may be a cause of action for tortious interference with that contract, even though it's unenforceable, unless it's illegal, unless it's void as against public policy. In this situation, should the court find that this contract fails, this covenant not to compete fails for lack of consideration, it is not automatically void against public policy, and the judgment against the defendant's tortious interference should still stand. Finally, Your Honors, I would point out that the law of the case applies here. Although the law has been fluctuating, in DeSantis, the court said, we're relying upon well-established common law principles. The cases seem to have different iterations of what the principles are, but ultimately in DeSantis and most recently in the Haas case, the court has again enunciated the three criteria which are basically derived from all of the centuries worth of cases that preceded them. This covenant was enforced by a temporary injunction which was appealed to the Dallas Court of Appeals. The court went down each of the criteria then set forth in Hill and found that those criteria had been met and determined as a matter of law that the covenant was enforceable. Specifically, it said it was ancillary to the employment relationship, and even past that, it's supported by independent consideration. That established the law of the case on the legal issues. The defendant at that time chose to fully develop and present those legal issues to the Court of Appeals. They are then bound by those rulings as a matter of law of the case in all subsequent proceedings, including the trial on the damage issues and including the trial on the tortious interference matters.
They're not bound here, surely.
I'm sorry?
Not bound here in this court, surely.
Your Honor, I believe that the law of the case is that they appealed that by writ of error. Filed application for writ of error to this court following the Court of Appeals opinion.
We didn't have any jurisdiction. Our jurisdiction over temporary injunction matters is limited.
The claim of jurisdiction in that case was that the case in the Court of Appeals, the opinion of the Court of Appeals, conflicted with Hill, conflicted with Bergman.
But we didn't, had we accepted that judgment, we would have written in that the case.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
If we had believed that, but we still didn't want the case, we would have written denied.
Yes, sir.
If we felt there was no, I mean, but we WOJ'd.
Yes, sir.
By never accepting jurisdiction, we don't pass on it, correct?
You do not have jurisdiction. Basically, that infers that the Court of Appeals opinion did not conflict with Hill and Bergman, otherwise it would have been jurisdiction. This court does have jurisdiction where the opinion of the Court of Appeals directly conflicts with Supreme Court precedent.
But that doesn't make it law of the case because we made that notation.
Your Honor,
because the conflict has to be absolutely clear. It can't be a maybe. So I don't see that our WOJ could ever be taken to bar.
No, what I'm suggesting is that the Court of Appeals, the appellants had a choice at that time. By choosing the appeal process at that time as opposed to trying the case on the merits and then appealing, they limited themselves. In that situation where you appeal an interlocutory order, you run the risk. It's a calculated risk, but they ran the risk of making that judgment the law of the case in the event that the Court of Appeals affirms.
Do you have any authority for that proposition?
Your Honor, those cases...
Under facts just like this one.
Yes, in the... I believe it's the FERS versus United Specialty Advertising cited in the brief at 385 Southwest 2nd, 456. That case involved an issue of trade secrets. After the injunction on appeal, the Court of Appeals held, as a matter of law, there were no trade secrets that were protectable. The case went back down and was tried on the merits, and that ruling was changed basically by the jury that awarded damages. On appeal the second time, the Court of Appeals said when the plaintiff chose to appeal the denial of the temporary injunction, he ran the risk of having those issues preclusively determined.
Supreme Court
NRE'd that case. Second appeal.
And the first time, was there an attempt to take it up to the Supreme Court?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't know what the writ history was of the initial appeal in that case. I'm sorry. As a final point, Your Honors, I see that I'm out of time. In DeSantis, this court specifically said that the covenant there's no question that the covenant is ancillary to an otherwise valid relationship, i.e., the commencement of Mr. DeSantis' employment with Wagner Hut. And that, I believe, is in accord with the restatement section 187 and 188.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. McCorkle, the non-competition period has expired, I take it.
Absolutely.
So there are no longer any possibility of injunction against this lady from competing?
No.
And then no question of damages. The only issue remaining, I suppose, is attorney's fees?
No. Well, there's a judgment against the corporation and her father. I think it's $100,000 by now. It was $160,000 starting out, I believe, or $130,000 starting out on tortious interference. And there were no attorney's fees, of course, in that tort case. But
what's the position of the tortious interference cause?
Well, the only reason we're here on that is because the trial court misinterpreted Clements versus Withers. And it's in the record. We argued that Clements versus Withers doesn't apply to non-compete. They're void as against public policy. He declared the non-compete covenant void and then turns around and let a tortious interference claim go to the jury. Hence, we're here before this court. Whereas in Fowler, that's been determined now that Clements versus Withers does not deal with non-compete covenants. That's other types of unenforceable contracts.
So you've got a tortious interference judgment for interfering with a void
non-compete covenant. And the judgment is against Donna Goldsmith's corporation, and her daddy's corporation, and her dad. Not against her, but now the Court of Appeals has reversed that finding of illegality as against her, and that's back before the trial court, presumably. I'm not prepared to talk about law of the case because that wasn't brought up here on the writ. It wasn't granted on that. But I think an exception to the law of the case principles, one great exception is that the lower court is incorrect. The Supreme Court's not bound by it. And the Supreme Court's not bound by it anyway. The Supreme Court of Texas can take a case anytime it wants, I presume, unless it chooses it and says it doesn't have jurisdiction. And that's limited by statute. Now, this case has been in the courts for 4.5 years. The term ancillary is not new. It's the first a lot of us saw when we read the DeSantis opinion, the second one, waiting almost 2 years for that one to come out. And it goes way back, 1929, in the case of the Potomac Fire Insurance Company versus the state of Texas. It was also mentioned at some length in the Justin Belt case in 1973, and Justice Gonzalez covered it, though shortly but very thoroughly, in the Dissent in the Hill case. So this is not new, and I'm sure the court is aware of that. This is something that's been in the law for a long time, and perhaps a long time ago should have been stated very clearly that these are the three criteria for enforceability of non-competes. Now, Mr. Roberts says that this contract was ancillary to an employment relationship. That's fine. It was ancillary to it. It was intended to be incidental to and in support of, but that's not what Criteria 1 says. Criteria 1 says it must be ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement. An otherwise, that is another agreement that's enforceable on its own. That's not present in this case. An at-will, and I don't, we didn't try this case on the issue of at-will. That was not in the case then. Nobody was thinking of whether it's at-will. You just have to look at the facts of the case and the record to see that this is absolutely an at-will employment contract.
How about the body of law that your opposing counsel has cited, that you're paid by month to month, that takes you out of the employment at will?
How you're paid is not determined whether it's at will. At will means that you can walk away from it without suffering any damages. The contract that you sign up for, that you agree to when you take a job, is for labor performed. And you're entitled to pay for labor performed.
It also
after
means,
the fact.
Also means that your employer can terminate you at any moment for any reason or no reason at all.
For absolutely correct. And if it's a month to month salary, you're not entitled to any pay if you don't work that month. And you're not entitled to anything in advance. Only
you're entitled to 30 days notice before termination.
I'm sorry.
Are you entitled to 30 days notice before termination?
In an at-will?
No.
Depending on the terms of the contract. On a month-to-month?
Yes.
Probably not. It's certainly not under the common law of this state. You can be terminated at any time. Whether you're entitled to severance pay, I think, is basically determined on what the policy is in the company itself, or perhaps even in the industry.
But here the employee was paid for work produced on a commission basis.
After the fact.
After the fee was generated, the commission was paid on a monthly pay period.
Yes.
Employment was at will, day-to-day basis, moment-to-moment basis.
Yes.
Pay period was on a monthly basis for work performed in the previous pay period.
That's exactly right. The will part of this was that the company, Star Tours, could terminate her at any time, and she could terminate her own employment at any time and walk away, which she subsequently did, but that's not what she was sued for. Not, she wasn't sued for breach of contract of an employment contract, but of a non-compete covenant. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tim. That concludes the arguments for this morning. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.